session, WZBU New Holstein Appleton, the Fox Valley's real news and great conversation, a civic media station.
This is an ABC News special report. I'm Wayne Cabot. Israel's military is hitting Iranian cities as we speak with missiles and drones, following Iran's attacks overnight inside Israel. What began as an Israeli military operation on Iranian nuclear sites is now edging closer to war. Both nations saying the attacks will continue. ABC News foreign correspondent Marcus Moore in Tel Aviv with the latest.
Iran's retaliation, missiles raining down on Tel Aviv. The IDF saying Iran launched dozens of missiles towards Israel. Air raid sirens heard in Tel Aviv as missiles fly over the city. The country's air defense system intercepting many, but not all.
The U.S. is helping Israel shoot down those missiles. Israel reporting 3 people died. Iran counting 58 of its people died over 2 days of Israeli strikes. And the U.S. military now adding extra security to all military installations inside the U.S. because of world events. This is ABC News. Rains in the forecast for tonight's military parade at the U.S. Capitol. Flooding is possible. It is the Army's 250th anniversary, and it's also President Trump's 79th birthday. ABC's Jay O'Brien.
There are no known threats to the Capitol, but President Trump saying earlier this week that if there are protests, they will be, quote, met with very big force. Another serious concern, thunderstorms are in the forecast for right around parade time, 6:30 Eastern.
Veteran Michael McPherson wants no part of the parade at a time the president is using federal troops to silence protests.
We will not allow tanks rolling through our streets and Marines invading our cities, terrorizing our neighbors, to be normalized.
No ICE, no KKK, no fascist U.S.
Protest today in 1,800 cities under the banner No Kings. Immigration top of mind, as you can hear from this protest in West Palm Beach, Florida. I'm Wayne Cabot, ABC News.
Remembering Vietnam, brought to you by The Dispensary.
One day we started heading back to dock towing some wounded guys in the truck, and the company commander said to stop the convoy. He said, "Where are the bodies? We had 2 guys killed, and they had been left lying back there. That can't happen." So the captain said, "We need some guys to go back and get them." I'm thinking, "I hope it's not me." And sure enough, he says, "Brzezinski, come with me. We're going back to pick up the bodies." And I'm like, "Captain, what do you mean? Can't we take the truck?" He said, "No, because they would just blow it up, and we can't afford to lose that truck." I took my helmet and flak jacket off. I could never run in those things, although I knew one well-placed bullet could kill me, and we started running back to the bodies. Mike Brzezinski, United States Army, Vietnam.
Hear this complete story at WISS.FM. Click on Remembering Vietnam. Brought to you by The Dispensary. Online at thed8dispensary.com. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Sholly Pittman. A new study highlights the high price of incarceration and says the annual total cost to families of Americans behind bars is nearly $350 billion. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
A new study highlights the high price of incarceration and says the annual total cost to families of Americans behind bars is nearly $350 billion. The study from Fora.us says 1 in 2 American adults has seen incarceration in their immediate family, with higher rates among Black Americans. Families with a member in jail or prison spend about $4,000 a year, and the report says for Black families, the cost is more than double due to longer sentencing. Zoe Towns with Fora.us says expenses like phone calls, care packages, long-distance travel, and new costs at home all contribute to the exorbitant price.
It also includes depressed wages over the lifetime of the person who's incarcerated, who's no longer able to contribute, but also to all the other members of the family. Oftentimes are also now experiencing lower pay just because of all of the shock of incarceration and the disruption that comes with that.
She adds the children of people behind bars usually see their own wages depressed throughout their lifetime, time even after a parent is released. Wisconsin's incarceration rate is among the highest in the nation. Black Wisconsinites are locked up at a rate nearly 12 times higher than whites, despite making up just 6% of the state's population. The report shows incarceration rates are also higher for people in poverty, with subsequent expenses eating up more than a quarter of the family income. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
For Civic Media News, I'm Sholly Pittman.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, slight chance of a shower or thunderstorm, highs in the upper 60s, mid-50s tonight with some rain after midnight. For Sunday, chance of showers and storms and highs around 73. For Monday, scattered showers and thunderstorms and highs in the low 80s.
It's 60 at our studios.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome nutritionist and dietitian from Wayless MD, Sherry Stoka. Then Phil Krause, owner of the Time Community Theater in Oshkosh, joins the show. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
This is 98.3 and 96.5 WISS, home of Matt and Air on Air.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. Thank you for joining me and my producer, Greg. We're coming to you from the broadcast stations of Civic Media here in Radio Park in Racine, and coming to you at a time in America of great concern, not only for the rights that we all have in this nation, but yes, indeed, for the threats to those rights, which often come in the nature of violence. The top of this second hour, we are here on Civic Media noting as well this reporting coming out of Minnesota that a Democratic lawmaker has been killed, another wounded in Minnesota in what appear to be politically motivated attacks. The reporting that one of those lawmakers, who is a state representative, her name is Melissa Hortman, that she has died, as has her husband, Mark. That confirmed by the state's governor, that of course is Tim Walz. He said the shootings appear to be politically motivated, shootings at their homes. It appears as well that there's another state senator, his name is John Hoffman, and his wife Yvette were both also shot in multiple times. Out of surgery right now, cautiously optimistic, the governor says that they will survive. Again, Governor Walz indicating this was an act of targeted political violence, and saying beyond that, that while he is briefed on the situation, more information forthcoming. Another sobering day in America. As we think about the importance of public service, whether you are in a Minnesota legislature, in a Wisconsin legislature, a local assembly group, whether you're a mayor, a governor, in the Congress, whether you're appointed to a position of judicial authority, elected authority, wherever you are in public service, that public service is to be regarded with great reverence because of what you're doing on behalf of the people of our nation. And today in our nation, we have folks who are looking at public service in ways that we have seen in the past, but now with increased senses of violence. We don't know anything about the shooter in Minnesota yet. We will certainly find out about that. But the initial indications, as Governor Walz has said, is that these are politically motivated. These are horrific violence under any circumstances. But it underscores once again what our president, my president, should be doing in these times and all times. Not only today when we have rallies happening around our nation in every state, what he should be doing is articulating with joy and with exuberance the notion that we are able to be and assemble in a country where we can articulate differing views and we can say things that may be offensive to each other. That's what freedom of speech is all about. That should be heralded today. And my president, again, not just in the wake of these horrific shootings now in Minnesota, but in other circumstances, should also be condemning at the highest levels. And perhaps he still will at some point today, condemning not only this political violence, but any violence visited upon anyone in America, especially in the context of handgun violence, which we have seen in America all too frequently. But the threats and the notions that we've got public officials, judges, others who are somehow acting in public service contrary to the best interests of America, those kinds of threats, they lead to this kind of thing. And today we have deaths in Minnesota of public servants, plainly targeted probably because of their positions on important issues of public concern. And notice, debating presumably in Minnesota, other places around our nation, they should not be losing their lives for that. They should be exalted for the debate that they engage in, presumably with others with whom they disagree. That's what it's all about. Today, we've got another sobering reminder that we need to do not just better. We need to address this. And my president and all governors need to say with absolute clarity that this is not America. Perhaps they will. Some of them will. All of them, including the president of the United States of America, need to pause today, even in the midst of that parade going on in Washington, D.C., and highlight the horror, the disaster, the catastrophe of the loss of public service servants, regardless of their political views and their animation. This is another tragedy in the history of America, a weekend of history in America. We bemoan and we mourn the lives of those lost, and we hope for the recoveries of those who were injured today in that shooting in Minnesota. Plainly here on this broadcast and others of civic media, additional information as that comes forward in our national attention. In that national attention just this past week, we have more judges who are issuing orders as a part of the things that public servants support. As a part of the things that people who go into public service, get elected, get appointed positions are all about, that includes federal district court judges who, yes, indeed, themselves have been not only murdered in this nation, have been threatened and continue to do so in this climate of violence and threats that is all too common. We have a district court judge who just this past week, her name, Denise Casper, she is in the federal district court for the District of Massachusetts. And she, this past week, just days ago, has sided with a coalition of states that brought a lawsuit into her courtroom. And she has said that they're right in asking that the court stop a stringent new voting ID requirement that President Trump attempted to set forth in an executive order in March. The ruling actually, again, in the context of what these judges are doing, going beyond what the specific request was for, the injunction, again, asking the judge here, Denise Casper, to stop what he, the president, has put in place. But it goes beyond just stopping voting ID requirements, proof of citizenship to vote, but also saying that there are key aspects of the Donald Trump's order that would overhaul election procedures beyond just ID requirements, in addition to indefinitely blocking those provisions that would allow the federal government to require proof of citizenship for new voters. Judge Casper also goes on to say that the directive to the Attorney General of the United States of America, that's Pam Bondi, as you know, to take action against states that continue to count ballots beyond Election Day, that's got to stop, too. She said among the states that are appearing in front of her, including 13 that do, in fact, under their own laws, permit the counting of absentee mail-in ballots after the official day of voting. They have to be received, of course. They have to be balloted. Voting has to take place by the election day itself. But if they're not counted
by midnight on that night. Those particular states permit the officials, permit the volunteers, permit those people in those county clerk positions, those local city clerk positions, to permit the counting to go ahead, to ensure that all of the ballots are counted. As a part of the executive order entered by the president back in March, he would prohibit any counting of those mail-in ballots that is not completely finished by those serving in polling capacities on that day. The district court judge, Denise Casper, District of Massachusetts, in her opinion, says that the states are likely to succeed in showing that the order in all of its aspects entered by the president back in March exceeded the president's authority under the Constitution. And beyond that, it risks disenfranchising some of the electorate. The ruling blocked the order from taking effect until the resolution of the case. Certainly, it's going to be appealed, as are all of these. But it's important to understand the significance of all of that as we go ahead here. In her ruling, Judge Casper cites a number of examples the states had raised that she said generated real concern about this disenfranchised possibility that she's identified. That is, by requiring people to prove that they are citizens, basically some ID in that connection, that could create chaos and confusion that could result in voters losing trust in the election process. And once again, here in the state of Wisconsin and in polling places around the state of Wisconsin, we've got ID laws. We plainly require that people come forward to be registered to establish that they are indeed residents of the area in which they're voting. You've got to establish residence. You've got to establish a number of other things, including residence for a certain period of time, that you're not a felon and so forth, that you are, in fact, a citizen of the United States as a part of registration. Beyond that, it requires some identification when you actually show up to vote. That's a part of our law in the state of Wisconsin. Many other states have other requirements greater and larger than that. But all of them embedded in all of that is the notion that people can indeed vote and should not be disenfranchised by the processes put in place by states. And the judge, Judge Casper, again, notes that that will happen if indeed what the president has commanded happen, which is the requirement that voters show up with some kind of proof that they are citizens, even if they're voting, even after they're registered, will cause problems. She said the problems include those coastal regions in Maine, where some residents are citizens but have Canadian birth certificates and no passports. That's a problem. New Mexico, where Native American Pueblo tribe members living in remote areas may have little documentation about their actual citizenship. She also pointed to situations involving individuals who change their names, that kind of thing being problematic. Others that involve older or homeless voters. She said citizenship documents are also expensive. This all part of her order entered prohibiting the president from going ahead with his executive order. She said, for example, in Rhode Island, it can cost up to $165 to obtain a passport. City of Providence, she said, $22 to obtain a birth certificate. She concluded that the burden created by the executive order appears likely to disproportionately disenfranchise Black and poorer Americans. At the key, at the foundation of all that she said is not only the burdens presented by this, but also the lack of constitutional authority. The president, as she goes on to say in her order, is the one person who does not have authority in this area. The Constitution, as we know well, does indeed give the president the obligation, the oath, to ensure that the laws of our nation are faithfully executed. But it does not prescribe, does not give to him any specific authority when it comes to elections. He is the one person who is not involved in this process, as we have said in other contexts. Instead, what did James Madison say? He said, this is a matter for the states to decide. Indeed, here in Wisconsin and in states throughout the United States, the states decide, the legislatures decide about all kinds of things related to how voting takes place, the timing, the circumstances, the trappings of that, as the Constitution provides. The president, Judge Casper says, has no authority in this area. And so she revokes everything that the president has done in this order, not only with respect to proving citizenship, but also this very peculiar and very oppressive statement that indeed, if there are jurisdictions out there that are counting ballots beyond Election Day, He says, I want my attorney general to go after them and take action against those states that continue counting ballots if, in fact, they are not completely done by Election Day. Now, effective this weekend, by virtue of what Judge Casper has done, that order, among the many others, is no longer in effect by virtue of her order. Will it be reviewed? Absolutely. District of Massachusetts, also a part of the First Circuit, going up there certainly for review upon an appeal by this president, and maybe ultimately, like all of these other things, heading to the Supreme Court. And when we come back here on Amicus Laudare, we'll talk more about the Supreme Court, what the Supreme Court did just past week in some major cases, also decisions about what it is not going to review in the coming term, all of that here on Amicus Laudare Review.
This is 98.3 and 96.5 WISS, home of Mino and the Mayor.
Looking for food, fun, and live music this summer? Head to Area 509 in Appleton with Caribbean Taste. Every Friday, enjoy a food truck rally from 5 to 8 p.m. with live music from 5:30 to 7:30. Starting June 1st, don't miss the Triple S Market every Sunday, 1 to 5. Sip, shop, and sing with local vendors, open mic, and rotating food trucks. And mark your calendar for June 14th. It's Second Saturday Music with Luminati from 6 to 10 p.m. It's all happening at 1025 North Badger Avenue. Come join the fun.
I'm still going for it, even with higher stroke risk from atrial fibrillation and a regular heartbeat not caused by a heart valve problem. Over a three-year study, Eliquis apixaban tablets reduced stroke risk better than warfarin, and over 97% of Eliquis patients did not experience a stroke. A first stroke occurred in 2.9% of warfarin patients versus 2.3% of Eliquis patients.
Don't stop taking prescription Eliquis without asking your doctor. It may increase your stroke risk. Eliquis can cause serious and, in rare cases, fatal bleeding. Don't take Eliquis if you have an artificial heart valve, abnormal bleeding, or antiphospholipid syndrome. While taking, you may bruise more easily or take longer for bleeding to stop. A spinal injection while on Eliquis increases risk of blood clots, which may cause paralysis, the inability to move. Get medical help right away for unexpected bleeding, unusual bruising, or tingling, numbness, or muscle weakness. Medications such as aspirin products, NSAIDs, SSRIs, SNRIs, and blood thinners may increase bleeding risk. Tell your doctor about all planned medical or dental procedures. Learn more at Eliquis.com or call 1-855-ELIQUIS.
Are you ready for some original funk, rock, and reggae? Well, if you're not, then it's time to start getting ready. It's Amanda with another new Wisco 411 for you, brought to you by Area 509 in Appleton. And speaking of Area 509, join them this Saturday from 6 till 10 to listen to Luminati as they return to their outdoor stage. So enjoy great music, delicious Caribbean food, and cold drinks. This Saturday, 6 to 9, head to WISS.FM and click events to find out more.
We are the National Park Foundation, and together with you, we're creating a future where every person, every generation, gets their chance at an unforgettable moment. Learn more at nationalparks.org/foundation.
As Wisconsin as a game of cribbage with good friends, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is Amicus Laudare Review. My name is Jim Santel. Thank you for joining my producer, Greg, and me as we continue to address those many things on the docket of America on this important weekend, an historic weekend in American history. Let's talk about what the Supreme Court has done just this past week in deciding six cases released just this past week by the Supreme Court. Many more to come in the weeks ahead. We know that on Wednesday, the 18th, is another day for them to release opinions. Thursday, the 26th, at the end of the month, another day that they have scheduled for the release of opinions in our national docket. Those things appearing before the Supreme Court on a regular basis. About 65 cases altogether, as we've reported before, pending before the Supreme Court this term. They decided something in excess of 45, 46 cases, depending upon how you count some opinions that were decided without oral argument. It is significant that among that 40 or so cases that the Supreme Court has released to this time on his docket for the 2024-2025 term. Here are some statistics for your information. None of them to this date has been in a 6-3 split. Interesting. That will almost certainly change in the next several weeks. But right as of now, half of the opinions, half of them have been 9-0, unanimous opinions. We've got four of those just this past week. Interesting, where all of the justices agree with each other. There's one 8-0 unanimous opinion as well. We had one recusal there. And there have been four 8-1 decisions, a significant number of divided opinions, including 8 decisions decided 7-2, 1 decision decided 5-3, 7 decisions 5-4. So all kinds of interesting statistics there. Almost certainly we're going to get more divided opinions in the coming weeks as some of these major topics, including things like birthright citizenship and the capacity of parents to regulate what is going on in the schools and the classrooms of their children with respect to storybooks that include stories and tales about the LGBT community. We'll talk more, as we will, about the decision coming out from the Supreme Court about whether or not states can limit transgender health care for youth. That's also pending. Many of the things on the docket of the Supreme Court still waiting for decision, almost certainly to be divided panels. But again, this past week on June 12th, the court issues 6 different opinions on various things, 4 of them unanimously. Let's talk about 2 of those among the 6, and they are important. One of them under the Americans with Disabilities Act, always a significant civil rights law to be abided by, and it's an affirmation, as it turns out, by the Supreme Court of the importance and the applicability of the ADA, and also then something under the Federal Tort Claims Act, which, again, a bit more obscure for most Americans, but something that I dealt with on a regular basis when I was a civil division chief in both the Eastern District of Wisconsin and Western District of Michigan on a regular basis. It's a civil law. Let's talk about that one to begin with. It has to do with a raid by the FBI that was botched, that was mistaken. What happened? Just on Thursday of this past week, Supreme Court rules that a family whose home, their residence, mistakenly raided by agents who set off a flashbang grenade, entered the home with their guns drawn, that the lawsuit that the family brought against them for the improper, the misguided entry into their home, this mistaken, this error-filled entry into their home, they should in fact be allowed to proceed on those claims under the Federal Tort Claims Act, which in many ways prohibits claims for tortious conduct by the federal government. Unanimous decision. Everybody agrees. The court ruled that the family should be given a fresh opportunity to try to persuade lower courts. Again, they're not saying by the Supreme Court decision here this past week that the family wins, but just that their claims are not barred at the outset. They should have their day in court, whether it's on motions, on a trial, that the lower courts should hear this case. And the federal government is not immune from a lawsuit over the harm that the agents who botched this entry into their home caused when they mistakenly entered this home. It happened to be in suburban Atlanta. The case is Martin versus United States. It arose from a raid very early on in a fall morning in 2017. And yes, FBI agents used a battering ram to knock down the front door of the home of the couple. Their names are Hilliard Toy Cliatt, C-L-I-A-T-T, and Curtina Martin, M-A-R-T-I-N. With their guns drawn, according to all the litigation reports, the agents set off a flashbang grenade and charged inside. Couple barricaded themselves in a closet, not knowing what's going on. The agents dragged Mr. Cliatt out at gunpoint, handcuffed him. They told Ms. Martin to keep her hands up as she pleaded to see her 7-year-old son, who is asleep in another room. This is calamitous, right? They questioned Mr. Cliatt. He gave his address. He provided other information. It was different from the one for the suspected gang hideout that the agents had a warrant to enter. They had another warrant. They were mistakenly at this place. One of the agents, whose name is Lawrence Guerra, who gives his name to this lawsuit, had earlier identified the correct house, which he said looked similar and was nearby on a different street. But on the morning of the raid, when all this happened, he said he went to the wrong house because he had been misdirected by his GPS device. That could not be confirmed. Justice Neil Gorsuch writing for the court. Mr. Guerra threw the device away not long after the raid. Justice Gorsuch, again writing for unanimous Supreme Court, added the agents had overlooked plenty of indications that they were in the wrong place. Yes, indeed. A street sign, a house number, and a different car parked in the driveway. The case turned again on the Federal Tort Claims Act, and that is a law that sometimes allows suits against the government for money, notwithstanding the doctrine of sovereign immunity, ordinarily barring those kinds of suits unless the government consents. Couples suing here for false arrest, false imprisonment, assault, battery, other claims, losing in the lower courts because of the purported bar of the Federal Tort Claims Act. Supreme Court reviving that, saying, nope, they've got a right to go ahead, probably in large measure because of the horrific nature of this entry, this going into their home with a battering ram and a grenade. And it's an important case, not only for this family, plainly, but for vindication of rights, for law enforcement, and under the Federal Tort Claims Act as that litigation proceeds. When we come back, we'll talk about another lawsuit under the ADA and other things that the Supreme Court has done just this past week here on Amicus, a law review.
Tom Hartman here. You're listening to WISS.
This is an ABC News special report. I'm Wayne Cabot. Israel's military is hitting Iranian cities as we speak with missiles and drones, following Iran's attacks overnight inside Israel. What began as an Israeli military operation on Iranian nuclear sites is now edging closer to war, both nations saying the attacks will continue. ABC News foreign correspondent Marcus Moore in Tel Aviv with the latest.
Iran's retaliation, missiles raining down on Tel Aviv. The IDF saying Iran launched dozens of missiles towards Israel. Air raid sirens heard in Tel Aviv as missiles fly over the city. The country's air defense system intercepting many, but not all.
The U.S. is helping Israel shoot down those missiles. Israel reporting 3 people died. Iran counting 58 of its people died over 2 days of Israeli strikes. And the U.S. military now adding extra security to all military installations inside the U.S. because of world events. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Game 3 of the Cards and Crew. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports Baseball. It's the Brewers and the Cardinals to play Game 3 of their 4-game series at American Family Field. Jose Quintana will face the Cards' Andre Pallanta. The last night, 6th inning, St. Louis had 2 base runners in a game tied 2-2. So Pat Murphy came out to the mound to replace Freddy Peralta. But then, at the last moment, the Brewers manager says he changed his mind.
The players play the game. I believe Freddy when he said, I got some more. You know, I wanted to check with him, and I got some more. And Arenado has been really good against Freddie. I think everyone in the ballpark thought we were taking him out. And I think, you know, when I trust a guy, I've been around Freddie for how many years, and I trust him. And I knew that it was a moment for him that he could get through, and that would maybe change some other moments in the future.
Peralta got out of the jam, and the Crew went on to win 3-2. NBA, the Indiana Pacers lost to the Thunder last night, 111-104, the best-of-7 series now tied at 2 games apiece. With Sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, slight chance of a shower or thunderstorm, highs in the upper 60s, mid-50s tonight with some rain after midnight. For Sunday, chance of showers and storms and highs around 73. For Monday, scattered showers and thunderstorms and highs in the low 80s.
Right now, it's 62.
This update sponsored by UW Credit Union. For every stage of life, UW Credit Union is here for every you. During every Brewers home game at American Family Field throughout the 2025 season, fans will have the chance to win a 2025 Land Cruiser. Courtesy of your Wisconsin Toyota dealers. Visit brewers.com/Toyota to enter. Join UW Credit Union at uwcu.org. Insured by NCUA.
Are you ever questioning when life will slow down? Are you ever thinking of just relaxing and enjoying the simple things? All of this is possible, even while still being in the workforce. Worthington, Minnesota is a town growing, yet it's nothing like Metro Life. Professional and labor jobs, a beautiful lake, bike trails, recreation, acres of public hunting, festivals, and great people. Slow down. We're just a short drive away, so come join us. Worthington, it's worth a look.
Mino and the Mayor.
DeLorean Walls in the house.
Y'all have been such a powerful platform for so many, including myself, that's bringing so much awareness. And just because the last couple of times I've been on the show, so many people have been asking, how can we help serve? And if we can get that normal, our community is going to flourish even further.
Mino and the Mayor, weekday mornings 6 till 9 on 97.9 WGBW and 98.3 and 96.5 WISS and the Civic Media app. The Todd Allbaugh Show.
State's Eric Kelder-Royce.
The vast majority of people on Medicaid are already working, and it is Medicaid that makes it possible for them to work. People who are disabled or have chronic illnesses and without that health care, they would be out of the workforce. They would have no ability to participate in the economy, and now they can. Medicaid is one of the greatest workforce programs this country has ever built, and they are trying to dismantle it, and with it, they're going to take people's lives and economic security.
The Todd Allbaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4 on your local Civic Media radio station, and on the app, Todd Allbaugh.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time. We'll talk with Tom Kircher of Wisconsin Watch about the weekend headlines and also check in with Clean Wisconsin on Pollinator Month. Join us.
The Todd Allbaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I'm your host for the remaining segments of this hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We are talking about some of the major decisions issued by the Supreme Court just this past week. Six of them all together, four of them unanimous, anticipating more opinions next week and the following week. We will, of course, cover all of that here on this broadcast, as will my colleagues on other broadcasts of Civic Media throughout the week. This is the busy time in America when the Supreme Court, again, typically June of every year, not really finishing its term, but deciding to issue these opinions typically before the 4th of July holiday in the summertime. Among the cases issued just by the Supreme Court this past week, a unanimous opinion, another one. Supreme Court again on Thursday of this last week, siding with a teenage girl. She has epilepsy, and her parents sued a Minnesota school district claiming that her school, the officials there, the teachers, others there, had refused to help her receive as much instruction as her peers. Sort of an equal protection argument there, but it's beyond that. It's also brought under the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is an attempt to ensure that people who have disabilities in America are afforded the same kinds of protections in all kinds of things, education and health care and housing, the basic trappings of life in America, that even though our legal system and the ways in which we respond to these great challenges are almost certainly imperfect and incomplete, we do the very best we can to ensure that every American, including those with immutable characteristics, including those with disabilities, have access to life. Unanimous decision. And the decision hinged on the standard of proof required to show discrimination by public schools in education-related disability lawsuits. This has been an issue that's been around for a while. It's written by Chief Justice John Roberts. John Roberts, the court holding that the student and her family needed to show only, not a higher burden, nothing higher than just the regular burden, only that the school system had acted with deliberate indifference, deliberately indifferent to her position, to her educational needs when they sued, saying that the same standard applies when people sue other institutions for discrimination based on disability. We talked last week about another case, again, in which a unanimous Supreme Court, in the context of employment rights, said, no, the same standard applies across the board to everyone, regardless of whether you are part of a majority, a minority group. Again, we've got that same kind of principle being articulated by the Supreme Court here. The school district had argued that a higher standard, a stringent requirement, a very high high standard that the institution acted with bad faith, gross misjudgment. You had to establish something at that high level should apply. And had that standard held sway here, the new standard might have applied broadly to all kinds of disability rights cases, not just those involving this young woman. As a result of the ruling, again, the student will now be able to press her case in the lower courts. She hasn't won necessarily. This, again, like the other case involving the FBI raid and the family, the question is whether or not they should be able to proceed at all. The Chief Justice writing that although the decision is narrow, critically important for children with disabilities and their parents. Indeed, that's right, Mr. Chief Justice. He said this. He said, together they face daunting challenges on a daily basis, adding that the court decision meant that those challenges do not include having to satisfy a more stringent standard of proof than other people who bring court challenges under federal disabilities rights law. The case is AJT. Those are initials. We do that because we're protecting the actual identity in courts, federal courts, state courts, of the actual name of the minor. AJT versus Osseo Area Schools stems from this dispute over whether a district near Minneapolis had provided reasonable accommodations for this young woman whose severe epilepsy made it hard for her to come to school and participate during regular hours. Ava's family advocating on her behalf, and the Supreme Court unanimously just this past week saying, yes, indeed, you can pursue that in the lower courts, including the Eighth Circuit. If, in fact, you are unsuccessful there, you can go back to the Eighth Circuit and you can get further review, arguably maybe coming back to the Supreme Court. Case not over, evidence not yet presented, but a real affirmation once again by the Supreme Court, unanimously, thankfully, sending the message that people who have disabilities not only have access and should have access under the law, but also to all the trappings of life in our nation. A couple of the things that the Supreme Court has done just this past week also worthy of note. One of them, of course, involving voting. The Supreme Court has agreed, announcing early this last week, that it would hear a case brought by a congressman who had challenged an Illinois election law that allows mail-in ballots to be counted up to 14 days after an election. All right, already you're thinking, gee, didn't we just talk about this? Isn't exactly what Denise Casper has written about in her very good opinion, saying the president has no capacity to tell the attorney general to go after those states that are counting ballots after Election Day? Indeed, this is all related. This is all the same kind of thing, attempts by our president and attempts now by this particular congressman to obstruct and to challenge and to stop an Illinois law among the states that does indeed permit the counting of ballots after Election Day. How does this work? Once again, those of you who do this regularly, who serve as polling officials, polling representatives in your local areas, know well that when those absentee ballots, the mail-in ballots, come in under Wisconsin law, we can't begin to count them until the day of election. That, too, perhaps should be addressed by our legislature, but those are the rules. Those are the rules in the state of Wisconsin. And because of that, the counting begins when the polls open. And if the ballots are so numerous that they cannot be counted, you continue to count them until, plainly, you finish with all of them to ensure that everybody who has exercised the franchise be sending in an absentee ballot, a mail-in ballot, including those coming in from overseas and our military bases. Everybody gets their right to have their vote counted. That's fundamental. And again, Illinois establishes a law, the state, acting under the federal constitution to establish the laws of the state, says here in Illinois, if you don't get done with counting all those absentee mail-in ballots by the close of midnight on Election Day, you can continue to count them because we want to make certain that everybody's vote is counted. And we have a congressman. His name is Mike Bost, B-O-S-T. He represents a district in downstate Illinois. And along with two federal electors, he sues the Illinois State Board of Elections in 2020. 2022. And they're arguing that this good state law in Illinois permitting counting to go on beyond midnight on the election date, that somehow it violates federal statutes establishing an election day. They maintain this because it allows absentee ballots to be received and counted after the election, that the election day in and of itself, the number on the calendar means something. And again, part of many, many attempts by members of our elected representatives and others, private citizens, in this case, two federal electors, challenging access to the polls. And again, the matter comes before the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, this past Monday, says it's going to hear that case. It's going to hear this case about whether or not the Illinois law that permits counting to go ahead should, in fact, it will be heard and will be heard in the coming term, whether that law is, in fact, in violation of the Constitution, in violation of the Voting Rights Act. The election dispute, as we know, is one of four new cases the justices have agreed on Monday to add to their docket. Many other things going on just this past week. Others include a case about whether immigrant detainees can sue a private detention company that they accuse of forcing them to perform labor. Supreme Court said we'll take a look at that case as well. There's a Montana case about whether law enforcement officers may enter a home. Once again, that story going on without a search warrant if they believe an emergency is underway. It's called exigent circumstances. That case, the Supreme Court has green-lighted for review in the coming term. A dispute about whether a U.S. soldier injured by a suicide bomber in Afghanistan can sue the government contractor who had employed the bomber. All those things coming up on the next docket of the Supreme Court. Also agreed previously to hear another high-profile dispute during the upcoming term, a First Amendment challenge to a Colorado law that prohibits conversion therapy that was intended to change a minor's gender identity or sexual orientation. Justices likely to add more cases again going forward. All of that now on the docket of the Supreme Court coming up in the next term, going to be decided probably in June of next year, just about this time next year. Significant that among those cases, we now have the Supreme Court, a majority of the Supreme Court, or at least four members of the Supreme Court, saying that we will take a look at the legitimacy of this Illinois law that permits counting of votes. It is concerning. Again, another polling case coming before the Supreme Court in the next term. Significantly, the Supreme Court also says from time to time that it's not going to be taking cases, right? That's called deciding not to grant the writ of certiorari. That's also a part of our civics instruction here on our weekend broadcast. When the Supreme Court grants a writ, that means send that lower case up here. We'll take a look at it. When they say no, we're denying the writ. We're telling you that we are not going to review the case. And in fact, the lower court, whatever the lower courts have done, that will stand as the law of this case. It is significant. It is significant that the Supreme Court, again on Monday, announced that it is not going to be entertaining argument on a major Second Amendment case, which we are thoughtful about again this weekend today as we hear this horrific news about the shootings in Minnesota involving the deaths of a legislator and her husband, the wounding of another and his spouse, presumably, according to the governor there, initiated, prompted by some political animus. We'll talk more about that, of course, at the end of our broadcast. Just this past Monday, the Supreme Court said it's not going to hear a major Second Amendment challenge, an attack upon a Maryland law that bans semi-automatic weapons like AR-15s. And is the court's practice, again, being followed here? Yes, they gave no reasons for that. But the move, over the objections of three conservative justices, permits the ban in that state in Maryland, the ban, the prohibition on semi-automatic weapons to stand. And it reflects kind of the court's intermittent engagement with gun rights. We know Bruin and Heller, those cases of the past, talking about the circumstances under which you can justify restrictions on Second Amendment rights. We've had Rahimi last term, where the Supreme Court said that, yes, indeed, if you're a person engaged in domestic violence, you do not have a right. You do not have a right under the Second Amendment. Again, affirming this notion that there is no right under the Constitution that's unconditional, including the Second Amendment right. It's significant. The Maryland law enacted in 2013 in response to what? In response to the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut the previous year, banned many semi-automatic weapons, imposed a 10-round limit on gun magazines. That's the law that will now stand. And here's the other important part of this. We have Supreme Court justices who wanted to take this case. In dissent, Justice Clarence Thomas said the court should have considered the question, which the justices, again, repeatedly, other justices have said no. Here's what he says in connection with the decision not to take up the challenge to let the Maryland ban stay in place. He says, I would not wait to decide whether the government can ban the most popular rifle in America. He says that question is of critical importance to tens of millions of law-abiding AR-15 owners throughout the country. We've avoided deciding it for much too long, he goes on to say. He adds that the court's commitment to the Second Amendment is inadequate. He says, I doubt we would sit by idly if lower courts were to so subvert our precedents involving any other constitutional right. Until we are vigilant in enforcing it, the right to bear arms will remain a second-class right. That's Clarence Thomas, just this past week, telling us that he would have taken this case, wanted to presumably overturn the ban on semi-automatic weapons.
As Wisconsin is dropping a line in your favorite fishing spot, this is the Civic Media Radio Network. There's no better place to catch Brewers baseball than right here. Every pitch, every hit, every home run.
And a fly ball to right center. Malloy is back, and this one is going again for Hoskins.
Brewers baseball on WISS is brought to you by Addison Jones Realty, Zeroni's Macaroni Pizza Pub, Green Thumb Organics, and Berkshire Hathaway Water City Realty. Catch Brewers baseball all season long on WISS.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government buy-in for the people. Tarrant County, Texas County Commissioners approved a new county redistricting map June 3rd, diluting the votes of Black and Hispanic voters. But commissioners claim the gerrymandering was for political, not racial reasons. The map likely eliminates a majority-minority district and has drawn widespread condemnation and a Voting Rights Act lawsuit. County Commissioners and Senior County Official Judge Tim O'Hare brought in the Conservative Public Interest Legal Foundation and the National Republican Redistricting Trust to draw the map, according to reporting by Democracy Docket. Their efforts apparently manipulated the districts to gain another GOP County Commission seat and a 4-to-1 advantage. Analysis by the UCLA Voting Rights Project and Southern Methodist University found the approved map packed District 2 Black and Hispanic voters into District 1, reducing the chance a Black or Hispanic candidate would be elected in District 2. Because the county staggers election cycles for different districts, it also disenfranchised as many as 150,000 voters, heavily Black and Hispanic, who can't vote in their current district's 2026 election and must wait until 2028. Voters sued under the VRA and the 14th and 15th Amendments. The commissioners claimed that they gerrymandered for political advantage, to which the Supreme Court turns a blind eye, and not racial discrimination. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. In discussions over the so-called Big Beautiful Bill, backed by Donald Trump, that's making its way through Congress, none other than Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson has emerged as the most prominent Republican critic of the bill, saying at a recent Milwaukee Press Club event that it is, quote, not even close to adequate. Johnson has said he wants spending cuts to go even further, including making cuts to Medicaid. But Johnson's position as a critic of this bill makes him especially influential in these negotiations. But let's not forget the last time he was in a similar position. In 2017, he was a critic of the Trump tax cut bill, but what he fought for was a tax break for certain types of businesses, perhaps not coincidentally, businesses owned by his largest donors, Dick and Liz Uline. In 2018 alone, the Ulines received more than $200 million in tax breaks because of this bill. So as the Big Beautiful Bill is negotiated in the Senate, let's not forget this piece of recent history.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area. Local news, weather, and sports on air and streaming on the Civic Media app. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. This is the final segment of our broadcast in this important weekend in the history of the United States of America. I'm going to spend some time talking about what my president, your president, our president is doing in connection with litigation and then also in connection with the breaking news of this day, this horrific story, reporting the news coming out of Minnesota. Let's talk first about some things in the courts. Donald Trump just this past week asking the Supreme Court to allow him to move forward with plans to dismantle the Department of Education by lifting that lower court order that we've talked about in previous broadcasts that prevented the department workers from being fired. The request comes again on, let's all say it together, an emergency application, which is the latest in this flurry of things that the Solicitor General is doing on behalf of the president since the start of the second Trump term. You recall well, President Trump signed an executive order on March 20th that instructed Education Secretary Linda McMahon to begin shutting down that agency, firing employees, a move that requires actions by Congress and, once again, not permitted by the Constitution, not permitted by legislation. Only the Congress can do that, and that's what the lower court rulings have said. No authority, Mr. President, and my president now pursuing that to the Supreme Court on an emergency application because it is so very important that the Department of Education, from his perspective, be shut down immediately and these fired employees kept away from the important work of the Department of Education. That happening just this past week. In his personal capacity, the president is also fighting to overturn his criminal conviction. It was returned, as you well recall, in that Manhattan District Court many months ago, finding that he is in fact guilty of 34 different felonies related to his attempts, recall this well, to cover up some sex scandals during the 2016 run for the White House. His lawyers have argued repeatedly, and this has been before the courts before, that the case brought then by the DA, the district attorney, his name is Alvin Bragg, in the state court there, Judge Juan Merchan, you recall, presided over this weeks-long trial that resulted in our president being found guilty. He was sentenced. He remains to this day a convicted felon, 34 felonies in violation of New York law. Lawyers arguing that it should never have been there, that somehow this action was federal in nature, that even though the president was doing all these things at the time, that he was a private citizen, that for some reason it is a federal matter, should have been brought in federal court rather than New York state court, and that the evidence in the case involved actions that were in his first presidency. And again, the appeals court, the federal appeals court, entertaining that as they are obliged to do. Prosecutors working for the Manhattan District Attorney's Office have countered that and said, of course, that this is involving state violations, attempts to disguise reimbursements from a hush money scheme to the porn star. They have nothing to do with the presidency and that Donald Trump was acting as a private citizen at the time. Second Circuit Court of Appeals has looked at this and is continuing to look at it. Again, leading to arguments just this past week in front of the appeals court once again to decide whether or not Donald Trump is right and all the lower courts are wrong and that this matter should have always been in a federal court. That also being pursued by the president in his personal capacity, although he might well say that this is a public official capacity thing that he's doing. Also significant to note that way back in 2023, you recall that several juries found that Donald Trump not only had sexually attacked a woman named E. Jean Carroll in that Bergdorf Goodman store in Manhattan way back in the 1990s, but significantly had defamed her in failing to acknowledge that and calling her a liar, telling the world that she is making all this up. We had several trials. We had several juries that came back and said, yes, indeed, Donald Trump, you have defamed E. Jean Carroll. And Donald Trump, again, seeking a hearing before the full U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. Once again, different case after a three-judge panel declined to overturn the judgment. Divided court left intact the decision upholding the jury's damages award. Appellate court denial of an en banc hearing came without an explanation. That is, we're not going to have the entire Second Circuit reviewing all of this. And again, that in the president's, Donald Trump's, pursuit of his various personal actions. We return again, of course, to what has happened and happening, breaking story in Minnesota in our final minutes here on Amicus Law Review. We know well about what the governor has told us. That is that there is one lawmaker dead. Her spouse also killed another lawmaker, injured seriously. His spouse also injured seriously. We know that the law enforcement authorities right now are looking for the suspect. Apparently, latest reporting that he may have been impersonating a law enforcement officer. On this day of history in America, as I indicated earlier, I call upon my president to say something, and indeed he has. He said our Attorney General Pam Bondi and the FBI are investigating the situation, and they will be prosecuting anyone involved to the fullest extent of the law. Such horrific violence will not be tolerated in the United States of America. Then goes on to say, God bless the great people of Minnesota, a truly great place. It comes close. It is not bad. But I ask for you, Mr. President, to say even more. Let us condemn all of these kinds of acts of violence. Let's stop the threats which you yourself have made with respect to officials on the judiciary and in other places of government, local, state, and federal. Let's spend the time today at the start of the parade that's going on in Washington, D.C., by announcing how horrific this is for all Americans, by describing the fact that this is not America, and say it with full throated vigor to all of us. You begin the process today by describing just how horrified you are about what has happened here, and you condemn this in the strongest words possible. And even as we celebrate the right of everyone to pursue the First Amendment and articulate their views openly, even views that are not popular in all directions, we also recognize that that cannot be done in the midst of violence today and at any time. That's what we need to hear from you, Mr. President, as we go forward today on these protests in states around the nation and in Washington, D.C. We'll continue to cover that story and other rule of law matters here on Amicus Law Review. I thank you for your attention, your focus, your engagement today, and I offer to all of you a safe and secure weekend. Take care, everybody.
This is WISS Berlin Oshkosh and WZBU New Holstein Appleton, the Fox Valley's real news and great conversation, a civic media station.
This is an ABC News special report. I'm Wayne Cabot. A man apparently impersonating law enforcement attacked two politicians and their spouses inside their own homes 8 miles apart in the suburbs north of Minneapolis. This update from Minnesota Governor Tim Walz.
We're here today because an unspeakable tragedy has unfolded in Minnesota. My good friend and colleague, Speaker Melissa Hortman, and her husband Mark were shot and killed early this morning in what appears to be a politically motivated assassination.
Also shot, State Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette, each shot multiple times. The Hoffmans now out of surgery. ABC News investigative reporter Josh Margolden on the victims.
Both Democrats, not saying that party has anything to do with it at all at this point, but both are Democrats. Perpetrator is now on the run.
Which is concerning. A list of other possible targets was retrieved from the suspects' cars. Security is being sent to protect those people named on that list. This is ABC News.